This is the Topic is Trek, episode 91 for Friday, May 14th, 2021. Coming up in this episode, in-person conventions start to become a thing again. Who knew? The Delta Quadrant is overflowing with spaceships. We forkingly split our reality, all that and more, right now on The Topic is Trek. We've engaged the Borg, planning June wedding. Welcome to The Topic is Trek, the podcast that runs on impulse power. Join us for a journey where no show has gone before. If it has to do with Star Trek, there's a good chance we'll talk about it. Sooner or later, because on this show, The Topic is Trek. Engage already. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of that fine, fine show, The Topic is Trek. As the announcer so eloquently just explained, on this show, The Topic is Trek. And I, of course, can't do it alone. I am one of your co-hosts, Clinton, but beaming in to join me with his new absolute killer, positively best ever sound effects is Mr. Craig Stepp.
Make it so.
Wow, that one is really taken. You would think you would know really? That.
You're not stretching very far this week.
I guess that one is a little on the nose, right?
Yeah. It's I like the way you were headed. You just didn't go far enough. And beaming in to join me as well
is Make it so.
That would be this show, yes.
Yeah. Is Mr. Chuck Tomasi. Hello.
You say you've engaged the Borg and you're planning a wedding. Where are you registered?
Pretty much everywhere, because they're just going to assimilate everything anyway. So, you know, might as well just...
Phaser's on target.
They walk into Macy's and assimilate the store.
Phaser's on target.
I see what you did there.
So bad he had to say it twice. We tried to ignore, he wouldn't let it go.
So as we're recording this, we got news today. We have some updated CDC guidelines, which tends to give more credence to the fact we may indeed be going to Dragon Con this year, gentlemen.
It's a possibility. I think it's closer today.
Be still, my aching heart.
So we 64-year-old heart.
Yeah, we don't know if we have a panel.
We never know. That's not until August 28th.
Yeah.
The only panel we know we have is a wood panel.
That's right. And even that's in question because of, you know, termites and so forth. But
cost of wood.
We will keep you informed should things change or update at a point in the future. But for right now, it is time to go on to our very first segment. And that, of course, is one that we know someone in particular just loves, just can't wait for us to start. Of course, we're speaking about subspace chatter. And Charlie, you're all set for that now, right?
Oozing with excitement.
Yeah.
You don't need all that subspace chatter.
You could tell. That was different. He did it different this time. Oozing with excitement.
The inflection was different.
Yeah. It was.
It's like the many faces of Spock.
Or Darth Vader. Or...
Well, despite what Charlie had to say about it, we are going to press on. So with our first story, here is Chuck.
Yes, it's been a while since we've heard anything about the Section 31 series that was planned for Michelle Yeoh's Emperor Giorgio character. And we can't be sure, but it seems like hopes for that show ever getting before the cameras are fading a bit. Yeoh was recently interviewed by Paul F. Tompkins of the official Star Trek podcast, The Pod Directive. That makes us something of an unofficial Star Trek podcast, I guess.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Yeoh, we haven't been endorsed yet. How about that?
We've endorsed the Borg. Wedding? No. Yeoh felt as if her exit through the Guardian of Forever would allow her to do things such as reappear on Discovery if Michael Burnham were in danger. The subject of the Section 31 show was not brought up by Tompkins, and we have to wonder if that was a directive given to the pod by people above Tompkins' pay grade.
Oh, it just seems a bit odd that you have her on, and that would be the logical thing to be talking about is something upcoming.
No, it's about her new coloring book. I don't know. That doesn't seem logical.
And per Giorgio's cookbook is what they were talking about.
Try the kelpian.
Full of kelpin, yes. Because that show was supposed to go into production. Was it after the second season of Discovery Wrapped or the third?
They should have already started, but I don't know.
Right. We already have Picard's second season rolling and Strange New Worlds rolling and nothing happened.
And we did get confirmation that it's going to be a real thing, right?
Well, that's the question now, is that they were talking about it initially like it was going to be a real thing. But things like this just make me wonder, is it? Is it really?
Yeah, I get the feeling they're kind of not sweeping it under the carpet, but just being mum about it, because I don't know if they want to commit yet. I get the feeling they're not committed to it.
It's on the shelf. It's not dead, but it's not moving forward.
I don't know. Well, we'll keep you apprised if things change at some point, but let's move on to our next story from Craig.
All right. Okay. And sometimes you get a subtle clue that your show is pleasing the network executives. Well,
money.
That's a good one. Yeah. So Viacom CBS is not being subtle when it comes to the people working on Star Trek Lower Decks. Back in December, we talked about how LDS, no, not Spock's LDS, but the creator Mike McMahon had signed an exclusive 2-year deal with CBS Studios. Now, studio writer producer Chris Kula has also signed an overall deal with CBS Studios, and Kula has previously developed for VH1, TBS, and Disney XD, and other initials that you might
want. Yeah. pick some out there. Just throw them in alphabet soup.
A, B, C, and D.
RCA.
As well as writing for shows such as Comedy Central's At Midnight and NBC's Community. I think everybody's worked on Community, didn't they?
LDS. The Latter-day Saints, right?
Yeah. Clinton, you should know. Everybody's worked on Community, right?
Well, not everybody has worked on Community. As I said, I have not worked on Community. Well, actually, I've worked on the convention, so I guess everybody has worked on Community. Yeah.
Same. I've done some community service.
There you go.
Hey, by the way, wouldn't that be just LD instead of LDS?
Well, the person on StarTrek.com was the one who came up with that one. There's inconsistency about how people are referring to Lower Decks. I think Memory Alpha uses LD. Another site uses LOW. But I just get a kick out of it, and I'm all behind using LDS because you can make Lower Decks out of that. Mm-hmm. And let's face it, LDS is an inside joke at the same time. And what better to have for Lower Decks than something that's an inside joke?
True. Okay. Well, I'll go with that. Sure. I'm down with that.
LDS is not funny. It must be stopped. Please give to the LDS Foundation.
Right. Well, in the end, all this is going to bring more stuff to Paramount Plus, right?
That's right. And speaking of Paramount Plus, in numbers recently revealed by Viacom CBS, the service formerly known as CBS All Access added 6 million subscribers in the first quarter of 2021, bringing the combined subscriber count between Paramount Plus and Showtime to 36 million. The service also saw a 65% jump in streaming ad sales.
Yeeks.
Bringing in a whopping $816 million. Major reasons for the continued growth were attributed to programming such as SpongeBob SquarePants, Super Bowl, and of course, Star Trek.
Has anybody ever mentioned SpongeBob and Star Trek in the same sentence?
And the Super Bowl?
Those commercials that were run for the Super Bowl that had to do with, Paramount Mountain and that SpongeBob and Star Trek in it. So there we go. Even we did it back then.
I guess an executive said that too, right? Hey, for the Super Bowl, let's run some Star Trek and SpongeBob.
I didn't see Tom Brady on Paramount Mountain.
He was there. He was on the backside.
He was jetting off someplace when he was done. The company said it would. Now, this is important, too. The company said it would invest more in original series and films for Paramount Plus. I refer you to the previous story that we just did about exclusive deals being signed by people involved with Lower Decks for development stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And in a marketing switch from its previous strategy, it plans to hold back more of its own productions for the service instead of licensing them to other streamers, which is a great idea.
Yeah.
In 2019, the company sold rights to South Park to HBO Max. Mm-hmm. It has also sold off such shows as Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan to Amazon Prime. Mm-hmm. And 13 Reasons Why to Netflix. Now ViacomCBS will try to fill its content pipeline from its own studios.
About time.
So look forward to more things coming to Paramount Plus. I think one of the things they talked about was, I forget whether it was a week, but some large number of movies they're going to be producing specifically for, not Star Trek in particular, but movies for the service itself. So I think we're going to see that service expanding as time goes on. So hold on to your, if you're legacied in on that initial with ads plan, you know, hold tight to that one because that doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, really?
Yep. That one's gone. So if you've got they have a low price plan now, which I think is $6, but it doesn't include your local affiliate station.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't even looked at the plan since I signed up for the thing.
I didn't either. I didn't even know about the local affiliate deal.
Oh, yeah. You can watch your local CBS.
So, okay. You get that plan?
It says live. Hold on to it. Yeah.
You'll still get it. If you buy the higher tier, you'll get it. But the low tier doesn't have that anymore.
The lower tier also has 65 minutes of commercials for every 15 minutes of television.
Bringing in $860 million worth of revenue. So there you go.
And there's right, no fast forward. Next story up.
Next story.
All right. We here at The Topic is Trek would like to congratulate Trek costume designer Gersha Phillips on some recent honors. Back in episode 87, we mentioned that Phillips and her team were among the finalists in several categories of the Canadian Alliance of Film and Television Costume Arts and Design Awards, also known as the CAFCAD Awards. Phillips and crew picked up a win for Discovery in the TV fantasy / sci-fi category, as well as one for costume building and tied with Odd Squad Mobile in the special effects costume category. We have a link to the entire CAFCAD Awards show in the show notes for episode 91 over at Topic is Trek, insert bell here, .com. The 5-minute long intro reel highlighting all the productions being shot in Canada is pretty darn freaking amazing. By the way, the award is a statuette of a full-size red maple leaf with a miniature costumer's dummy in front. Like that little black torso with no arms and no legs where they make costumes.
And of course, it had to be a maple leaf, you know, just had to be.
Yep.
Full-size red maple leaf depends what tree you got it from. I mean, I've seen big maple leaves and small maple leaves.
Well, I was just implying that it wasn't like a one-dimensional kind of a carving or something. It's a full-on three-dimensional.
It's a little flat though.
Leaf. And speaking of one-dimensional,
thick are leaves where you come from?
Yeah.
Speaking
this
of
award
one,
is flimsy. Look at
I
this.
I get hit in the head with a leaf, and it's crushed my skull.
Speaking of one dimensional, I believe Craig is up next.
Yes, wait, what?
Ow, that'll leave a mark. All right, checking in on the convention scene. There is good news and bad news. First, unfortunately, the bad news. One of Trek's biggest conventions, Germany's Destination Star Trek, has moved. So the destination is not. It moved its date out again.
Oh, so originally, the destination didn't move, but the date moved. No. Okay.
Yes, exactly.
Well, then why do they call it Destination Star Trek? Well, how do you know when you're there?
Like herding cats, people doing the show, like herding cats. Go ahead.
So originally planned for October of 2020, organizers, massive events, made the right move to postpone until a later date. In this case, June of 2021.
Sounds good.
However,
sounds plausible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. However, even that date has been proven to be too optimistic. The convention has been moved yet again and will now take place in Dortmund, Germany, in September of 2022.
Oh, ouch.
Another so the good news months. Is that Destination London, which had already been originally planned for October 2020, will be going ahead with its originally scheduled date of rescheduled date. I started to say they're not going forward with October 2020.
No, that would be very weird.
Their rescheduled date of November 12th through the 14th of 2021.
Now I have to read this next line like Robert Picardo.
How do you do that?
As a hologram.
Yeah. As a hologram.
Please state the nature of the medical emergency. Done.
That's right. All right. That's it. So Robert Picardo released a video announcing the firm date and toasting to finally being together again.
Well done.
Indeed. Really?
We throw darts at it and it worked.
All right. Well, have you ever wondered what it takes to produce an exact replica of a film or TV prop?
Yes.
Well, we'll wonder no more. See, just wonder no more. As we previously reported, the Wand Company announced some time ago that they are producing a top quality replica of a Hero TOS tricorder. Through a series of emails sent to people expressing interest in the replicas, the Wand Company is taking people step by step through the complicated process of creating something new that is indistinguishable from something over 50 years old. The updates are also made available on the company's website, and we have links to the first five updates covering topics such as carefully scanning one of the last remaining original TOS tricorders created by Hua Chang. And that's it's in pretty good shape considering, although they go into details of what has happened to it. Deciding on how to fit all the 21st century electronics into a functioning, including a functioning display into the existing space of the prop, 3D printing prototypes, working out how to replicate the removable data disks, and a lot more. And they're far from done with this whole process, but it's fascinating to see some of the parts of this, including doing the 3D scanning, because not only did they have an armature to do the traditional, what you kind of think is more of like the camera carefully going around it. Mm-hmm. They had a handheld, almost looked like a speed gun type of thing, but it was also using a scan on the surface of the tricorder, mm-hmm. building up the cloud map of what the device was like. And they talk about how this being one of the remaining original tricorders, apparently was disassembled between the first and second seasons because they needed to make a bunch of lesser quality ones just to have a bunch for the show. And when they put it back together, some of the pieces weren't put back in correctly or weren't put in at all.
Right.
So there was definitely some damage done to it. But it's in surprisingly good shape. And then the decisions have to be made at some point because now it's slightly off square. So you have scans.
Oh, the scans are going to give you a bad template.
Right. So the person who was doing the scans and also working on the 3D model said the best part was being able to actually hold the thing and be able to see why it was off. And give it a gentle, because the owner was like right there watching every moment.
What are you doing?
Give a gentle nudge to the aluminum frame to see, okay, this is what it would square up to be. So you would actually know what it was supposed to be like. And it would be data that would not be included with your scans, because your scans would show this like bulge someplace that really shouldn't be there. Type of thing. But it's fascinating to think about having to create this and have it function when the real one didn't even function.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, the X-ray version of it looks pretty cool. You can kind of see into it.
Yeah. So they opened up all the compartments and the drawers in it. And, you know, some of that stuff had been removed as part of that disassembly process and not put back correctly. But there were also like little indentations and so forth on the inside that you would never know by looking, obviously, at the television show or, you know.
Well, yeah, it's not like they did a show and just showed that right in your face. It's always in somebody's
hand.
They've
had some close-ups. But
yeah, there's some close-ups. But, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, hugely on screen all the time. So you didn't see
it. So is the hero... This is the TOS one, right?
Yes.
Okay. Did they get to the part where you hook it up to the stone knives and bearskins?
No.
They're scanning those as well.
Yet to
they're scanning those as well.
You're going to get a vacuum tube with... Wait a minute. I'm already set.
Laid out on a whole board.
There you go.
I got a vacuum tube right here, so I'm all set to go.
Why do you have one at the ready? Good
Lord. Why not?
Craig. After 16 years of podcasting, you ask about odd things laying around the desk.
You're right. I don't know why.
All right.
Like, I like this little treble. There you go.
Exactly. Punch cards, vinyl records.
I will say one thing before we move forward. This on the second page, I think, where they're scanning it with the handgun. It looks like he's pointing a phaser at it.
It does.
Chuck, if you haven't seen this, you have to go look.
So be sure to check out. We have a link to all of them in the show notes. Oh, no. See, he's not going to be able to do that over in episode 91 over at the Topic is Trek.
Insert bell here.
.com. All right, Chuck, you have our final story.
And finally, if you can't get enough of the Delta Quadrant, because I know I can't.
Right. Yeah. That's right.
And the premiere of Star Trek Prodigy is still too far away. Well, we have you covered. The new book, Star Trek, The Borg and the Delta Quadrant, Akrotirion to Krenim, note that's only like half the alphabet, is filled with facts and illustrations about the ships of the USS Voyager encountered during its time on the far edge of the galaxy. Written by Star Trek authors Marcus Riley, Ian Chaddock, and Mark Wright, this is the first of two books. Here comes the second half. That will cover the wide range of spaceships and aliens that helped to hunt or try to assimilate or... it was just a bad time. Janeway and her crew, they had all kinds of fun, so why not put it in a book? The second book, The Delta Quadrant, Ladozian to Zol. See how we did that? H-I-J-K-L. Yes, it is a seamless alphabet.
Indeed it is.
That will be out later this summer.
And It's good to see in retrospect all the different ships. There was a post on Facebook, and I think it was Trek Yards, but might have been some other group, where they were showing the ships that you see in Discovery in the third season that are the Federation in the 31st century. And people are having these comments about, it doesn't look right. And I'm thinking, you have to extrapolate something beyond the present, if you will, of Star Trek. And in this case, with the ships in the Delta Quadrant, they have to be all alien looking. They really shouldn't look like anything we see in the Alpha or the Beta Quadrants. They should be completely different. And some of them are kind of strange and out there.
Just drew a blank.
That's okay.
Wow.
You're not much of an artist.
You're going to have to take away I can't draw a blank. The Kazon ships had an interesting architecture to them. They didn't look like anything we'd seen before. And, you know, frankly, the bigger ships were pretty massive in size.
And it's another thing that always you want to avoid, I think, is you don't want every ship to be exactly the same size. You notice how usually if the Enterprise gets bigger in the next generation of Enterprises or of Federation ships, well, the Klingon ships and the Romulan ships amazingly get to be exactly that much bigger themselves.
That's because it's an arms race.
Right. But there's no comparison. So the fact that they're different sizes would make complete sense.
Yep.
Hey, by the way, speaking of ships,
which we just were.
Yeah. Doug Drexler on Facebook, he's been posting pictures of some of the ships that he helped design, including the Enterprise C You know, there's, which is some really cool, interesting features of that, because he's got some designs that look similar, you know, that they kind of batted around and then they kind of settled on something else. And the Botany Bay, and he posted another one in here anyway. And I was going to say, I invite you to go find him on Facebook and look at some of his pictures. He's always posting something really cool.
Wouldn't it make more sense to have smaller ships? I mean, as you get bigger and bigger ships, and the captain's on the bridge and he says, hang on, I got to get down to engineering. 20 minutes later.
Well, actually, I know we're going to talk about it here in a minute, but start the Romulan ship in 2009. I think that thing was huge. They had to jump, you know,
that's what I was thinking too. And that's kind of where I got the idea. Like, what, how do you get anywhere quickly? I mean, the turbo lift doesn't take you to the exact
point. It was big enough for Spock to fly out of it. I mean, it's huge.
Right. Hang on, I'm on my way to cargo bay 3.
It's going to take me 10 minutes to get there.
At least.
Yeah.
I'm just, on my Segway.
That's right.
You just have one of those poles like in a fire station. There's a
For getting down. Good luck getting back to the bridge.
In space, you know, you can just kind of, there's no up and down. It's, you know, it's all good.
We'll be talking about that movie in a little bit.
All right. But sadly, there's no news yet on getting someone from the Vulcan Alberta Canada Visitors Center on the show yet. But we will keep you informed on that. And we give our best to everyone in Vulcan Alberta Canada, hoping that they are doing well. But we have covered a lot of stories in this segment here. We've laughed, we've cried, we've talked about the Delta Quadrant. But we have links to an additional 53 stories that we did not have time to cover. Everything from a theory that Picard knows about Michael Burnham and the Discovery. I'll give you a hint on that one. It has to do with mind melds and what maybe Picard gleaned from mind melds with Sarek and Spock.
Good point. I didn't think about that. Yeah.
To a 10-second moment in Star Trek Lower Decks that led to endless debate among the production team. And I'll give you the 10-second read on that one as well, because there's so many stories in here. Deal with that one was, as you know, in Lower Decks, you see the scene where the Cerritos backs away from the fight with the Borg.
Yes.
Well, that caused a lot of discussion of, would they do that? Why would they do that? And if
for
you
humor.
Notice, there's lots of, well, yeah, it's humor, but they're still a Starfleet vessel. So why would they be doing that? So the discussion went on, you ended up with more and more and more Romulan ships in the scene. So it became more and more apparent that, well, the Cerritos is definitely outgunned. It's not meant for that type of thing. And there's already like a dozen Romulan ships there battling this cube. So we'll let somebody else in the Federation know that this is happening and we're going to leave now.
Yeah. We'll report our findings later.
So that's the type of thing that I think is endeared Lower Decks to everybody, that, you know, you see it, but somebody said, yeah, I wonder, let's think about that for a bit. What does that actually mean? Excellent, excellent, excellent. All right. But with that said, it's time to disconnect from subspace chatter. So my favorite part of the show is to say goodbye, Charlie.
Happy Charlie. Think happy thoughts. Think happy.
I want to stay.
That's one listener that wants to stay.
The fact that he keeps repeating it over and over again really makes you feel like that's an echo. Oh, I'm sorry. I just thought he just kept saying it over and over.
Right. Don't look at the echo button, Chuck.
I'm looking at it.
Look away.
All right. But it's time for an appropriate sound effect, because we are going to head out on our main mission.
This or nothing. Ah, rats. Static again. Yeah. See if you can adjust the opto-isolator linear chips.
All right. I'm just going to have to, I'll reverse the polarity.
Reverse the polarity fixes everything.
Perfect. All right. Now, this time around on Main Mission, we're talking about the 11th movie in the Star Trek franchise, Star Trek. Although, just like the reboot of Doctor Who, many fans reset the numbering system. To this one is the first movie of the modern Trek era.
Darn kids!
And just to make things more confusing, since the title of the film is so generic, we often refer to it as Star Trek 2009. So quick, Chuck, give us some actual facts about this thing.
Star Trek, a.k.a. Star Trek 1, a.k.a. Star Trek 2009, as you just said.
Screen hey, Kelvin timeline.
Kelvin, a.k.a. Altverse, a.k.a.
JJ Verse, a.k.a. Kelvin yeah. time. Yeah.
Screenplay was by Robert Orsi and Alex Kurtzman. Music
what
by...
What happened to Alex Kurtzman, by the way? Anything, what did they become of that kid?
He won't amount to anything.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Music was by Michael, I'm going to try this, Giacchino. I'm Italian, and I'm not sure I buy that, but okay. Directed by J.J. Abrams, premiered May 8th, 2009, 12 years ago already. Blink of an eye. Oh, wait, that was another episode. That was... already 6 years and 5 months after Nemesis. And you remember Nemesis, we covered it on the last show. And we mentioned that that film was the worst performing film of the entire Star Trek franchise.
But that... I think we all loved it, by the way.
Share your pain
sorry,
with me.
I had something in my throat there, sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. That film made $67.3 million. Oh, if I could only make a bad movie that made that much money. However, 6 years later, Star Trek, a.k.a. No, we won't do that again. It made almost four times that much with $257.7 million.
And that's just domestic, people. Just domestic.
Yeah. So here's a brief synopsis.
The wild ones were... Oh, wait.
Yeah, sorry. That was, so here you go. Here's a brief synopsis. In the year 2233...
In the year 2233.
Yeah. More than a decade after the launch of the USS Enterprise, a massive Romulan mining ship emerges from a mysterious void and destroys the USS.
Huh? Hello, Spock.
Yeah. Destroys the USS Kelvin, killing James T. Kirk's father and unintentionally creating an alternate timeline.
I am your father.
Again.
Wrong franchise.
When the ship reappears years later and attacks the planet Vulcan, it is up to the crew of the newly commissioned Enterprise to defeat the Romulan captain's plans to destroy every world in the Federation.
My name is James T. Kirk. You killed my father. Prepare to die.
All right, so some fun facts about this movie. The crew of the USS Kelvin used communicators that were the same style used on the original series. You can see that when the engineer comes into frame, when George Kirk's wife is contacting him during the evacuation of the ship. After Nero changes the timeline and begins the alternate universe, the communicators change dramatically.
Oh, I hadn't noticed that. That's a wonderful factoid. Now I got to go watch it again.
When Chekhov manages to transport Sulu and Kirk aboard from the fall from the platform, he shouts, "Yuri Mayor," which is a Russian exclamation of surprise, an exclamation roughly corresponding to English, "Oh, man!
Holy crap!
I did it!
Mayor!" I love that little expression he has.
And speaking of that space jump, the actors were initially filmed on harnesses facing downward, as one would do if one was making that jump. However, they constantly passed out from the rush of blood to their heads. So J.J. Abrams ultimately came up with the idea of filming the actors standing on mirrors. When shot from the angle, the reflection of the sky behind the actor gave the appearance that they were actually falling out of the sky. And this is the first Star Trek film to list its cast in alphabetical order rather than by who the leads are.
Oh, interesting. I had not noticed.
This was done to reflect the ensemble nature of the film's cast. And I went back and checked. So, yeah, we start with John Cho and then Ben Cross, Bruce Greenwood, Simon Pegg. We end up with Anton Yelchin.
Wait, and then we J doesn't come before B. John, then Ben.
No, you the last names, not the first names.
Oh.
Anyway, but we have two that are outside that rule. We have Eric Branagh, who is Nero, and Leonard Nimoy there post those parts of the credits.
Itself. Spoiler alert.
Yes. All right. So with that said, it's time to discuss Star Trek 2009, Star Trek 1, Star Trek, the one without the whales, whatever, however we want to refer to this one. So I want to kick things off. And my first question to everybody is, what did you think of the casting in this movie?
Oh, I thought it was spot on for sure. I think especially from McCoy. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, I'm
trouble. Carl Urban.
Carl Urban. I was
Kurt Cobain.
That would have been completely different movie.
Kurt Cobain.
I think he was perfect. I think he played it just right. And Chris Pine. Even Zachary Quinto. I think they all did great. Even everybody.
Carl, he started out a little too over the top when you first meet him on the little shuttle.
Mm-hmm.
But he kind of grew on you, or he melded into that role as the movie progresses, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. He was given an interesting task in that scene to convey how much McCoy really doesn't trust a lot of this stuff. You know, and McCoy doesn't. McCoy, you know, is not a fan of the transporter or any of that stuff. So right away, okay, being pushed onto a shuttle and we're heading off someplace, and he's just like, I'm not a fan.
Well, also keep in mind that he just got a divorce recently. And so he's a little jaded.
Yeah, that was the part that felt a little over the top. You know, my wife got everything. Oh my God, my bones.
Yeah.
Like, well, yeah, it was a little forced in some spots, but
maybe a little bit, but then you get the kind of idea of where the bones came, where the name came from, the nickname. Right.
It's a different origin.
Why you have bone, because bones is traditionally a name for a doctor that has to do with actual bones,
saw bones.
So it was a different take on it, but if you're going to try to origin the name in like 3 seconds, okay, then that's where you're going to origin the nickname.
Good thing he said bones and not something else.
Yeah.
Oh, I got my big toe. Yeah.
Okay, toes.
We'll just call you ass for the rest of the show.
I got my ass.
So thank goodness for that.
No, but I thought he was spot on. What you're right, as after they went into Starfleet Academy, he kind of mellowed out a little bit, but I think it was just right from then on out.
Okay, so how I know we're holding a bit on McCoy here. How did he go in as a candidate but was listed as an officer when he got assigned, and I mean automatically promoted?
He was already a doctor.
Okay.
When he went in.
So
he said he was part of the medical staff. I forget he was not the chief doctor, because it gets appointed that when the chief medical officer gets killed.
Right.
But he was part of the senior staff, and probably because he was already a seasoned doctor, whereas I'm guessing a lot of people that were going on the ship were recruits and probably just out of medical school.
Okay. So kind of like if you got a college degree, you're more apt for officer training. Okay. Yeah. I'll buy that. And for what it's worth, I did like Carl Urban as McCoy.
Yeah. And I think he was a little older too, you know, because.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. So he had age and he was a doctor. So
how about Zachary as Spock?
I was not sure at first when I heard about the casting, because I thought, okay, he looks very much like Leonard, but it can't just be that. You've got to do obviously much more than that.
Yeah.
And I felt he delivered on that. He was trying to convey all the things about Spock that we know about Spock, but not trying to be Leonard Nimoy,
right?
Doing those things.
And the point that really nailed it in that movie was when he was in front of the Vulcan Academy of Sciences board, and they said, you know, nobody's ever turned us down before. And he says, well, in that case, all I can say to you is, live long and prosper. It was like the biggest FU that you could give them in Vulcan culture.
Yeah. I loved it. And you could see just a hint of anger in his face without losing it.
Right.
You know,
right.
Which I thought fantastic.
I noticed that is the recurring thing you can just poke Spock and get a very visceral reaction out of him. You mentioned his mother and
watch out for the yo mama jokes.
Yeah, exactly.
Right next to the dog faced boy.
Yo mama's ears are so pointy.
Don't get the rest out because you're dead at that point.
Actually, one actor I was a little bit concerned about. I love Simon Pegg, but I wasn't sure about him as Scotty when the movie was announced. I was like, I don't know how that's going to work out. But I think he kind of nailed that character as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because he took on a comic relief role that Scotty really didn't have previously, but you needed to have, I feel like, somebody be that person.
Mm-hmm.
I like this place. It's exciting.
Yes. I love that line.
and I believe the line, I think it's in the blooper reels when he says, you know, can somebody get me a towel?
Yeah.
That was just an ad-lib line. And Kinto has just kept cracking up and couldn't get his next line out. He just kept laughing.
I think I did see that. They did like 20 times. Yeah. He kept laughing about it. Yeah, it was pretty good.
But speaking of that, this was a production that I don't know if I was reminded of this when I was going through some of the trivia, that this movie was shot while there was a writer's strike going on in Hollywood.
Hmm.
So the film script got locked at a certain point and they couldn't change anything in it. And so I'm wondering, and I don't know the rules on this, so I'm wondering if ad-lib lines were okay as long as you didn't have the writers okay it.
Yeah, I would imagine that would be the case. Right? I would imagine that'd be the case because that's a choice the actor is making, not necessarily the writer.
Right. But if you went to the writer and said, well, Simon just said such and such, is that okay with you? And they
don't know.
And if they'd I think they would have to say, beats me. I don't know. Because
they slide notes across the table, you know. Yes.
Could be.
Check yes or no.
Blink once for beep once for yes or twice for no.
Yeah. I did enjoy speaking of characters, I think the ship is kind of a character in itself. The Enterprise.
Yeah, I wanted to get into that because we have, in my opinion, we have two different Enterprises going on here. We have the Enterprise that is the outside, the bridge, medical bay, the corridors, and then we have engineering.
Oh yeah,
that was filmed and looks like it was filmed in a Budweiser brewery.
It was
I said it looked like and was filmed in a Budweiser brewery.
Yeah, actually, I kind of like the piping and the whole thing.
Well, when he walks through the plate with the big steel cylinders, shiny everything, it reminded me of the boiler rooms in the Titanic or an old steamer like that.
We're going down.
Yeah, I was like, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like it stood out too much like that. They spent too much. If they had used a little bit of special effects work to mask some of it, but I feel like all they did was put, you know, like radiation stickers on some of the canisters and things like that, and put in some freestanding communications things and so forth. Mm-hmm. The Kelvin one was filmed. The Kelvin engine room was filmed in a old power plant at Long Beach. Mm-hmm. So that was also, and we don't get to see that much. So it's hard to have a judgment about that, but it almost like an old power plant sounds like it would be more in line with what you think engineer would look like rather than a brewery. I don't know, but
well, they were brewing Romulan ale
through the pipes that Scotty was swimming in.
Exactly. Yeah.
By the time these pipes weren't on the blueprints, that's where we
next
something special.
And of course, there's the resistance to the Apple Store bridge.
Actually, I thought it was a little refreshing. There was too many of the lens flares, but
my eyes are burned.
Yeah, but the visuals we did get to see, I thought it was kind of cool. I wouldn't say it was in line with what TOS, like the Discovery Enterprise is to TOS, mm-hmm. as opposed to this one. But you got to remember, maybe because of the Romulans came and altered everything and it changed their design flow because of the alternate timeline. Oh, we got bigger threats and
right.
You know, just change it up a little bit, but I enjoyed it.
It's the only ship that has like a ship's throttle on it that, you know, you see Sulu push forward like, oh, well, engine's to full.
Yeah, we saw Riker use the joystick.
Oh, don't get me started on the joystick.
Sulu in Star Trek The Motion Picture used the same thing to get to warp one. He had a throttle.
Mm-hmm. Oh, did he throttle it? Okay.
Yep, it was an actual throttle he was moving to get it to. He's like, warp 0.5. And he just kept going up that way. There definitely was, and we talked about that in that piece of trivia, there was the implied, because the Enterprise itself, I believe, is twice the size that it was on the original series in this movie, that because of the incursion of the Narada, that the trajectory of what Starfleet was doing changed, mm-hmm. and that they became a lot beefier in their defenses.
I forgot to mention, this was the first Blu-ray that I ever bought. And I remember Donna's expression when we put that in and the Paramount logo came up and we were just blown away. I was like, I can't wait to see the rest of the movie. That was enough for
rewind
us.
Rewind it. Let's watch it again.
The first true.
We watched those stars 16 times.
And it made this, you know, whoosh sound. Like, I'm sold.
He's more familiar with the top of Paramount Mountain than Patrick Stewart is.
So getting back to the ship, you see it partially constructed on the land. And yet it has the NCC 1701 on it.
Already, yeah.
It's half built. The plates aren't even on the hull. And yet they've decorated it. That doesn't make any sense.
All right, since we moved to Riverside, Iowa,
which
which I find interesting because that's an inside joke as well. The fact that it's Riverside, Iowa, which is Riverside, Iowa is the place that built itself as the future birthplace of James T. Kirk.
So but he was born in space in the alternate timeline. Whoa, what happened?
That's right. But he now just lives in Iowa.
Yeah. With his uncle.
The death place of.
Here's a question to you. Now, we know that it's a fleet construction yard in Riverside, Iowa. All right. We see the Enterprise being built there. We don't want to get into the fact of how much it's going to cost to heavy lift that thing up into orbit and why is it not being built on Mars and blah, blah, blah. Okay. It's clearly for visual effect that Kirk can ride up to it on his motorcycle and see it. But why was Uhura in Riverside, Iowa?
Along with several other Starfleet people.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand some security people being there, like, you know, Cupcake was there because maybe security, but why was Uhura there? The ship wasn't built. It's a construction yard. She's not assigned to the Enterprise.
Well, if memory serves, she was buying some drinks.
Yeah, why?
You can buy drinks other places. I don't
know. Maybe she was visiting some friends.
Oh, I can imagine Uhura having lots of friends in Iowa.
Well, look, she was in San Francisco at Starfleet Academy.
Yes.
You can't imagine. I mean, I can't imagine that it was that stretch to go, I'm going to get on a transporter and go see my friends in Riverside, Iowa.
They didn't have the site-to-site transport back then.
No, you would have to get on a shuttle to do it because they were shuttling from Riverside to Starfleet Academy. You know,
maybe she caught a ride. I don't know.
There's a rockin' party in Riverside, Iowa tonight. I'm there.
It struck me as odd going, but why is she there? There's nothing there.
I didn't even consider that.
No offense to Iowans out there, but let's face it. She's in San Francisco and she's going to go to Iowa to order a Budweiser.
Classic.
I don't know. I didn't understand that part of it.
I didn't really give it much thought. It's kind of followed her character into the bar.
One of the drinks she ordered was a Cardassian sunrise. Do we know about the Cardassians at this point?
Well, remember, Do we versus does the Kelvin timeline know about the Cardassians at this point?
Fair. Okay, we'll let that one slide.
Right. And I think that's the thing. And I was also brought back to the fact that a lot of people said they couldn't follow that this was an alternate timeline, that they didn't, like, that wasn't explained to them. So I wrote this down verbatim. They're having a discussion on the bridge, and Spock says, "You're assuming that Nero knows how events are predicted to unfold. To the contrary, Nero's very presence has altered the flow of history, beginning with the attack on the USS Kelvin, culminating in the events of today, thereby creating an entirely new chain of incidents that cannot be anticipated by either party." And Uhura then says, "An alternate reality?" And Spock says, "Precisely." They literally tell you word for word.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're on some kind of Star Trek.
Yeah. Some astronauts. Some kind of Star Trek.
So when Kirk comes running up on the bridge and he's explaining that Vulcan is under attack and that they intercepted this communication, and Uhura simply states, "Yes, there was a communication." Spock then says, "If this is true, we must accept Uhura's conclusion." She didn't make any conclusion.
She made an inference. Like,
I literally snapped my head and went, "What conclusion did she make? She only offered."
Hey, wait. Spock is emotionally compromised when it comes to Uhura.
That's right.
Yeah, that's true.
He's going to agree with her if she said that her uniform was green.
Well, we're there at the moment. What do you think about the fact that in this timeline, Uhura and Spock are a thing? And silence.
I'm mixed about that. I think it was, I'm not sure why it was put into the movie. It didn't really add much. I mean, there was that one moment where, you know, "I'm truly sorry for you," you know, and they were emotional on the transporter pad, but it didn't pan out.
Well, also in the turbo lift before he.
Yeah. When she was consoling him after the,
I think the only reason they did that was to be able to write for all of the characters rather than having some character kind of pushed to the side.
So she already had a strong part as a xenolinguistics and deciphering messages. No,
then you had Kirk trying to figure out what her name was, and you know, everybody's I don't know.
I think that one of the reasons they did it is because for those people who didn't hear what Spock said, the idea of hammering home that things aren't the same in this timeline. I mean, that coming out of left field is like, well, that's not a thing. Well, no, it's not a thing. In the prime timeline, it's not a thing. And so I think that was just, in some ways, it was just meant as that, you know, kicking the head to say, "You get it now. This is not the way things are."
So you're saying that you think that they assume that it would have changed some cultural differences.
Yeah, I think a lot of things
are just the relationships between the people.
Right. I think the same thing. I think they start to go overboard with it in some ways, because then you also have two additional things that we can talk about. One is the death of Amanda.
Can I start there?
Well, but we've got two things here, right? So we're talking about, you know, things aren't the same. So you've got that, and Vulcan is gone.
Which you can clearly see in the daytime from Delta Vega.
Yes, well, that's a separate issue that we can deal with as well. So you want to talk about Amanda.
Since when do we start doing countdowns on transports?
I think they were doing the countdown on the transport because Chekhov trying to do it, or was it Scotty and
Chekhov was doing it, because remember he's the one that lost her. He was kind of devastated when he.
Okay. I think because he was trying to get the lock, and the lock was
the gravity kept changing.
Yeah, so it was going to
You had the
X amount of time for the thing. So the computer might be giving a readout. It's like, you know,
hold on, I'm calculating. Loading, loading, loading.
Please wait.
The loading bar is going up. By the way, I miss Anton Yelchin.
Yes, yes. I think that just it. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought, speaking of which, I thought he did a good job.
Yes, he did.
Putting his own, it was his own spin, really, because he's, I think he was younger than the TOS checkoff, but
yeah,
it's a little different. But I thought
17, he did a great job. 17.
Yeah. Okay. Great. It's a kid. It's a
kid.
Yeah, I think that he's also another one that very much like Simon had to, you know, figure out the accent, mm-hmm. because the accent is not a real accent. Yeah. So what is he going to do? Because he can do a Russian accent, but he made a point of saying, but I couldn't really do my real Russian accent because that's not Chekhov's accent. So he had to dial and alter his accent to make it work to be an homage, not a copy, but an homage mm-hmm. to, you know, to Walter's Russian accent. And the great thing is we get one of the best bits in the entire movie out of it. Victor,
yes. Nuclear whistles.
He's in your code.
Which we also get to that same scene there. That's also Majel's last appearance in Star Trek. She recorded that, I think, 2 weeks before she passed away. Her lines on the computer in that scene.
Oh,
wow.
Didn't hear that one.
So that was bittersweet as well,
mm-hmm. yes.
on that one. But yeah, so that's my theory anyway about why they were doing a countdown, that it was a tricky thing to be doing because they didn't give a countdown when Spock beamed down to the planet.
Yeah, he told him not to move. Don't move.
Exactly. And for some reason, Spock crouched, and I don't know why he crouched.
Yeah, because he was out in the open on the rocks.
So I don't know whether
when he beamed down, you mean?
Yeah, he on the transporter pad before he beamed down.
I want to pounce on. Yeah, that is kind of weird.
The elders can be kind of tricky, so I got to be ready. And I got to stick it.
On a side note, I did like the way they changed up the transporter beam. You know, it kind of was circular.
Oh, the whirly thing now.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of cool.
Swirly transporter. Can we talk about red matter?
Yes.
Oh, yes, please. Yes. How does one
obtain or generate or create red matter?
I didn't go back and look at the Countdown comic, and I can't remember if the Countdown comic does any discussion about that or not.
And why was Spock flying around with this big ball of it when all you needed was a drop? That's dark matter.
Dark red matter.
Nibbler makes dark matter.
Well, we don't know how much was going to be needed to do what Spock needed, right? Because when he's using a drop of it, I'm trying to think, do we show what Spock ends up doing? Because
you can create a singularity out of a drop.
Right. But it seems like that singularity is very contained. So I'm thinking that the Narada does not get sucked into it, which eventually a different story, but you use a very small amount of it. So how much was Spock going to need to stop the effects of the supernova? It might've been a great quantity.
I'm sorry. I took my headphones off when Chuck asked the question, but I think he had the same thing. He's like, why did they send him with all of it?
Right.
How did he get that much?
Okay, well, I'm checking right now. I have the film up, and Spock just uses a very small amount, just like Nero uses.
Yeah, they use it. He stick a needle and get a drop. I'm like, why did you send him with that big ball of it?
Exactly.
Well, here's a theory about why that I can't guarantee is a real thing or not. You give Spock all of it so that when he's done with what he needs to get done, he sends the ship off headed out of the galaxy because nobody should have it. So he uses whatever he needs. Maybe he needs a little, maybe finds out that's not going to do it. I need more. Fine. You take all of it. And when you're done, we don't want to see this thing back again. We don't want it in our, galaxy. Get it out of here.
Huh? Okay.
Where did it come from? And why is it so dangerous? And how do you prevent somebody else from making it?
Well, like I said, I can't recall if the Countdown comic, which does a lot of background on Spock working with the Romulans and so forth, and coming up with this plan, whether they address where red matter was developed.
There were some serious physics questions that needed answering in this movie.
Oh yeah, well, I think one of the biggest questions that I think we had while watching the movie for the very first time is, I don't think ejecting the warp core near a black hole, can the explosion of that, I don't think, is going to push you away from the singularity.
If anything, it's going to blow you to bits.
I mean, you may get a shock wave, possibly, if the black hole is not strong enough to envelop that as well. But I didn't, you know, so that was weird.
Kirk, Sulu, and Olsen jump out of a shuttle in space.
Hold on,
you're in space, and yet they are sucked down to the planet by gravity. If that's the case, right next door is, what's Nero's ship's name? The Narada?
Narada.
Yes.
That's just hanging there. Okay. Why isn't it falling down?
Well, I have the impression that Pike gets as close as he can to the atmosphere on his way to the ship.
He flew a straight line. Line from ship to ship.
Did you look at his flight plan?
Yeah, you didn't
see. They did a wide shot, man. He was straight lining it.
So all right, I'm gonna give him the benefit of the doubt that he swung wide enough on the curved atmosphere to get as close as he could. He's pointing them down. Now, what they would need at that point would obviously be
heat shields.
No. What they would need at that point is, because you have to assume that the suits that they have on are doing that, but that they are being not so much dropped, but slightly ejected out of.
They would have to be ejected because.
Right. So they would have the momentum at that point to be headed in the direction.
But they didn't have any rocket packs on.
No, but there was air in the compartment. So if they opened it up, it'd push them out.
That's not the effect that they gave on screen. Anyway, okay. That was just one of my physics gripes. But
now we thought we were going to say, okay, they all go into the shuttle. Everybody in the theater goes, oh, that guy's wearing red.
Yes. Kirk, yes, Sulu, and Olsen get onto a shuttle. Which one's not coming back?
Survive? Yeah, exactly.
Olsen had the charges.
Let me tell you a joke. Kirk, Sulu, and Olsen, you're in a shuttle.
All right. Let's see. What else we got here? Yeah, so we let's get back around to Delta Vega. Now, I will concede that calling a certain planet Delta Vega could vary between prime timeline and the Kelvin timeline. Sure. That part, you know, fine. So the fact that it's a nice planet versus what we saw previously in Star Trek, that's fine. But it would have to be, you know, at first you want to say a moon of Vulcan, but of course Vulcan does not have any moons. It would have to be a planet in that same system for Spock to see it from, and Delta Vega just doesn't seem to fit as a name that, because Delta Vega then would have to be a planet that I guess the Vulcans named originally in the prime timeline or something. I don't know. So I can't figure out, why would you even call it that? Why would you call it something Vulcan sounding that it's a sister planet in the Vulcan solar system?
It was this named after a couple of old cars.
I had a Delta, I had a Vega.
Hey, there you go. Hey.
Hey, I think that they, in some ways, I mean, I love catching little Easter eggs or seeing callbacks, but sometimes I think that they bend over backwards to put too many in there.
Okay. Things like such Delta as Vega. Are Centaurian slugs the same as SETI eels? They sure look similar.
No, they're not the same, because one goes in the mouth and one goes in the ear. Fun fact.
Depends on the doctor and who's prescribing.
Thank you, David Attenborough.
And where the pain is. And at one point they said, I believe it was when Nero was telling the story, or no, Spock was telling the story, a star threatened to destroy the galaxy.
Hyperbole. He exaggerated.
Vulcans do not exaggerate. No, wait, Vulcans do not lie. They exaggerate.
Okay,
you might have it there.
Yeah. Hey, but going back to the red matter for one second, I just found this page. It was on Reddit. Somebody said, was mentioning that alternately, you know, there were had some other stuff in there. It may be simply that it was feasible to transport in a huge ball. We see that smaller quantities are extremely volatile.
Okay.
So, you know, remember when it busted up on the Narada, it went and then kind of did its thing. And of course, Spock took a small sample out. So maybe it was better to keep it together than take out small, tiny bits.
Okay.
Unless you're going to use it.
We saw this drill twice, once on Vulcan, and they shot the heck out of it. And they said, the drill is destroyed. But yet, they had another drill on Earth. Was that drill, or did they fix it?
No, they said the drill was destroyed.
Disabled. It was disabled originally.
Right, it was destroyed when it was
on Earth.
Chopped on at Earth.
Narrowly missing the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yes, well, but George and Gracie.
Dodged a bullet there.
George and Gracie didn't survive, I'm just letting you know.
Hit George right in the head.
Just letting you know.
I did like the Spock's little ship. I forget the name of it. The one he had the red matter on. I thought
I want to say it was the Dragonfly, but I don't think that's right. But a name like that, which I was going to look up just before the show started, and I forgot to do that. So I'm gonna go with Dragonfly, but it was a name similar to that.
Oh, one person we haven't brought up is Bruce Greenwood.
Yes. Are the second of now many pikes that we our pantheon of pikes.
Start putting some heads on pikes.
Yeah, pretty much.
No, he did a great job. I did like the way he did that.
Yeah, I think that he played it very, very straight-laced, but with a touch of humor to it.
And he had that little father-like deal with Kirk.
In the bar scene, I love the way that he figured out what Kirk's motivation was, and he nailed him when he said, "I dare you to do better."
Oh, yeah. Like,
that's exactly what he needed to make a move.
Yeah, even in the trailer when that was in there, I was like, "Ooh, that's kind of chilling. I dare you to do better." He was like, "Wow, I thought it was powerful. That's a good line."
Just think the first time around, the Narada killed Thor. So I mean, geez, you know, it's just gonna
he just didn't have powerful. Yes. Hey, I'll tell you what, and we're gonna talk about it in the next time we review the next movie, but there's a moment with Bruce Greenwood and Chris Pine that is so subtle. I think it's the best acting I've seen in a long time. And we'll talk about it in the next movie.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, yeah. We'll talk about it in the next movie, but it's just their interaction. I think had that father type son relationship. And I really think they nailed it.
Mm-hmm. Never really had. I mean, he definitely would be a father figure because he never met his real father, and his stepfather is obviously a jerk. So,
I had one more note about the drill. Why did they drill in the water in San Francisco Bay? How are you supposed to make a hole?
Missed it by that much.
Right.
They were aiming for that courtyard. They were just a little bit off, and no one wanted to tell Nero that we kind of miscalculated by a few.
They were aiming for that little parking lot on the side of the Golden Gate.
And if you're trying to drill to the core of a planet and the core is molten, that's the same thing. You're drilling through liquid and it's just going to fill in the hole. And they say, we've reached the core. Oh, that's good. Yeah, I hope Vulcan had a solid core because that won't matter.
Solid core.
But that's why I feel like they were using a very small amount for very controlled, that they were trying to get it as close to the core as possible because they didn't want to use so much that they put themselves in danger, that this was.
Yeah, why didn't they go to Riverside, Iowa? And get you to the core. There was a quarry there.
They can go right to the
core. They had a big hole.
You go straight to the Corvette and just keep on going at
that point. And as Vulcan is imploding, they say, we got to get out of here in a hurry. And they just go. They didn't get away very fast. Now, there were a number of things that I really did like in this. I like how they didn't turn Deep Roy's character into Jar Jar Binks.
Yes.
Yeah. He was mildly amusing enough. Yeah.
I really enjoyed the classic light across the eyes for Chris Pine when he's sitting in the captain's chair. That very Kirk light across the eyes.
Yep. The scene where the Enterprise is rising out of the Titan, that was magnificent.
Clinton, that wasn't just like, it was a lens flare. That was reflecting on it.
Get that. My eyes. And did anybody not have a reaction to that first scene? Is everybody like really stoked and go, I'm not crying. You shut up. I'm not crying. The opening with
the car?
With Kirk's birth and
death and all
that kind of stuff.
Actually, when they showed the ships spread out, you know, kind of gave you a sense of a scale, and they were actually getting away. That was kind of emotional with the music. I thought they did a great job.
I love the music in this movie.
I also noticed that one of the things that Giancino does is he gives you a couple of times the first few notes of Alexander Courage's, you know, fanfare, just the first few. And he made a point of saying that they had to earn the entire theme. So that's why you don't get the entire theme until the end credits, when everybody's all together and the ship heads out. You would just get occasionally like, da da, and that's it.
Oh, yeah.
Just like these little bits earlier on.
I thought the thing, to talk about the theme for a moment, I think the theme was as good as the first time we heard like the TNG style theme. And I thought I was, because, and they've used it again, but I thought it was as impressionable as that was.
And I like the use of the, I forget, it's a real instrument, but the one that he ends up using for a Spock's music, it's a very unusual string piece that he has someone come in and do the recording of that theme. So it sounds otherworldly, like it's something you would hear on Vulcan. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a nice touch as well. And the thing I liked about space is that
it's so they big. Used
all the freaking different angles instead of every single shot of the ships were straight on.
Like flipping them over.
You would start underneath and then go above, or, you know, start from this angle and go over to that angle.
Mm-hmm. Especially at the beginning when they're showing the Kelvin, you're like, what am I looking at here? And then they kind of, that's pretty cool.
Just like that video we watched where I'm not crooked, you're crooked.
All right. Well, I think we've run out of the major things we can say about this.
Sulu can fight.
And he has an amazing sword that just kind of pops into existence.
It's like almost a lightsaber, but it's a foldable. It's like one of those toy lightsabers you buy. You know, flips out.
It reminds me of that X-Acto knife I have, where if the blade gets dull, you snap off a piece and extend a little more.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. Yeah.
That's what it is. And a quick shout out to Ben Burtt, by the way, who came in and saved the audio effects. Ben Burtt, who obviously is from Star Wars, did a lot of work on.
Man, I love Star Ben Wars Burtt. Movies,
but he came in at kind of near the end of the process when JJ said to him, you know, I feel like something's missing, or you just had him screen the film. And Ben Burtt said, well, where are the things like the pings, that classic bridge ping? Where are those things? So a lot of that stuff that's in there is because Ben Burtt said, you need to have that stuff in it. That's part of what Star Trek is.
I think Ben Burtt is the pinnacle of that job, because when I was a kid, I watched the making of Star Wars. I remember, I think I've talked about this on Technorama before, where I saw him playing with, it was just a wrench and a microphone on a guy wire for a telephone pole. And he's like, doing, and he would take that. Yeah. And he was making the laser sounds, and it just blew my mind as a kid. I did the same thing. I was like, it works. You know, I've, you know, played with Foley stuff because of that. I think he's a little bit of an inspiration.
Yes. Well, you do know what a photon torpedo sound is from Classic Trek, right?
Which, what is it?
It's a suspended slinky. It's a suspended slinky that's hit from one end.
Oh, yes. Of course.
I used to do that, yeah. And you put your ear up to it, and you
yeah.
So
yeah, you ever hear listen to Ben Burtt talk about making the like the Wookiee yell? You know, it's like a lion and a couple other animals, mm-hmm. and it's slowed down and sped up, or slowed down rather, and it's pretty amazing. Anyway, the topic is Trek.
Yes, the topic is Trek. But the topic is also
our other podcast is called On Another Note.
Yes, it's called But I Digress. All right. So it's time to rate this one on a scale of, and we're going to do, we're going to do red matter. I don't know.
What wait, because less scale? Is more.
I mean, lens flares.
Okay.
Oh, very good, my.
Very do you know?
One to 100 fact, lens flares.
A fun fact for me, my last rewatch of the movie, which was mm-hmm. early this week, mm-hmm. I did not notice the lens flares once. Not
I didn't really pay
once.
Attention as much this time. Yeah, I didn't either.
So I don't know what that means because, you know, obviously I used to notice them and now it's just like, they're just there and I just didn't even notice them anymore.
Yeah, they weren't as overt. And I'm obviously using the exact same DVD I had back then. So it's not like somebody remastered my copy.
Yeah. Right. Well, they were over the top, of course, but I liked the use of them, but he had too many of them. Right. Because it did give you a little bit of a futuristic feel to the photography. But well, yeah, there was way too much.
I believe it was in Into Darkness where he himself felt he went overboard and had to have them digitally removed after the fact because
you know, the guy's going, oh, we can add them easy, but oh, God, right. Gotta remove them.
Cause they were done mostly. A lot of them were done as practicals just with actual mm-hmm. light shining towards the lens. Yep. Okay. So 1 to 10 lens flares. Who would like to go first?
Hey, that's within the first 5 minutes of the film, yes, by the way.
Okay. Go ahead. I'll go first.
Yeah, right. 1, 2, 3. Let's all go. I'm just kidding. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm going to give this 8.5. I really enjoyed the film as much crap as I give it about the physics. It was a nice fresh start to the franchise and music, casting, characters, effects, all right up there.
All righty. And I'll go next and I'm going to go slightly higher. I'm going to give it a 9. Ooh. I really, really like this film. I put it in to watch it the other day and Bonnie sat down and started watching with me and it just like the time just flew, you know, then it was over and it's just like, I just wanted to watch it again. Cause it's just, I like how this film was handled. Mm-hmm. So I'm giving it 9. And how about you, Craig?
I kind of agree with both of y'all. I'm also going to give it a 9. Excuse me. I'm gonna give it a 9, and I think that, as you said, this is one of my go-to Star Trek movies that I'll, even if I'm not really watching it, just turn it on maybe to watch a little bit of it or something. I do it all the time. This is a great go-to movie. I love the casting. I think they all worked well together. And the only gripe I do have, and I will not give it a 10 because of this, is there was not enough McCoy. There's 3 main characters that tie the thing together, not just 2. And I think they focus on Spock and Kirk a little too much in the movies going forward. But Dr. McCoy, and he's
at least McCoy gets some darn good zingers in there.
He does. But and in the next movie, I think he's got a little better role. But it's the 3 of them together, not just the 2, that makes the dynamic. So
he had the classic line, are you out of your Vulcan mind?
Yeah, that's right.
I have that on a t-shirt now.
He had some good stuff.
Yeah, so. you need to have that. Of course, it was hard in this movie to do that because they aren't really assembled as a team yet, but to have that, those classic discussions between the 3 of them.
Yeah. Even like we talked about with all the TNG movies, Data and Picard, Data and Picard, Data and Picard. And, you know, It's just then you mix it up, and the three of them together are the,
all right,
you know, the formula. There you go.
Ooh, okay, this is a long episode. We're gonna have to get through our warp speed roundtable.
Yep. Well, hence the term warp speed roundtable. So let's get right to it.
Warp 10.
This time around, we're asking a very simple question. I'm sure very, very simple for people to answer. Which of these companions would you take along on your voyages? You're heading off on a starship, you know, for your first assignment or whatever. And you have five choices. You can either bring along Spot, of course, is Data's cat, Porthos, Archer's beagle, Grudge, and yes, she is a queen, so we understand that, Aichaya, which is Spock's Saylot, or we found one with a name, Boshar, who is Dr. Antax Targ, so a Targ. We'll just Targ, but we found one with a name. So which of those five would you want to take with you on your voyages? Let's see. We'll go in reverse order for this. So we'll start with Craig.
All right. Well, I'm going to pick, it would have to be one of the cats. I'm going to go with Spot because all the other animals you have to walk and clean up after. Something that just scoop the cat box and walk off. So I'm going to go with Spot.
Well, yeah, there's another cat though. I mean, why not Grudge?
Yeah, all the hair.
Okay.
That was a big cat. That was a big cat. And
thyroid condition.
You're going to walk in your quarters and stepped in a cat ball. Yeah, hairball.
Well, all cats are going to do that.
All right. Well, I'm going to go with Aichaya. I mean, a little long in the tooth, although one of the teeth is broken off. But I still think that, you know, he can be cuddly like a teddy bear, but it's still a bear. So in case there's trouble, there's a bear with me. So I think it's the best of both worlds there. All right. What about you, Chuck?
I'm going with Craig. I'm going with Spot. I thought the personality was the easiest one to get along with. I mean, I liked Porthos. Porthos had a nice, you know, as dogs go, that was a very nice dog. Beagle, easy to get along with, was well behaved. But I just... more of a Spot, even though I have an allergy for cats. Maybe that's fixable in that century.
Wait, you got an allergy to cats? You've had cats.
I know.
You got one.
It's getting worse as I get older.
Hmm.
Thank goodness for Allegra. This show is brought to you by Allegra.
And no love for Targs in any way, shape, or form, apparently.
Not a Klingon kind of guy.
All right. Well, those are our opinions. If you have a different one, please be sure to let us know. We'll give you some information as we head up. But right now it's time to refill the lithium chamber.
Wait a minute. We didn't have our write-in answers.
Yeah, I got a write-in answer.
Oh, you did? Okay. This just in.
Go ahead, Chuck. You got yours?
Yes. My write-in answer, my companion is going to be 7 of 9.
Well, you don't have to walk her.
Like herding cats, people, I'm telling you. Yeah.
Well, I was looking at Livingston, Picard's red line fish. Because he's venomous. You know, I figure you could.
How did you find out?
As long as you can get somebody to put their hand in the bowl, that's great.
Where do you, it was basically a sphere that stuck out of the wall. Where do you even put your hand?
He had to go walk behind the wall, and there's, you know, kind of like at the pet store, you know.
And since these were just plywood sets, that was pretty easy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you got it.
How did you find out the name of that fish?
Just, it's on, what you call it?
Memory Alpha?
Memory Alpha, yes, thank you.
Mm. How did find out the name of the fish? I don't think it was ever Livingston mentioned.
Livingston was a lionfish kept by Captain Jean-Luc Picard in his ready room.
I have a feeling Livingston was one of many lionfish. Probably was a Livingston 1, a Livingston 2, a Livingston 3.
Because Jellicoe had to obviously cycle him out at one point. Put that fish in airlock.
Yeah.
Here's a baseball you can take with you. All right. Anyway, time to refill the lithium chamber and try to warp on out of here. You can find me, Clinton, at Comedy Forecast. That's Comedy Forecast, all one word with the number 4.com, where I do a podcast, very short form comedy podcast. You can also find me on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and MeWe and maybe the spare tire in your trunk. Who knows where you might find me.
Hey, your short form podcast has gotten a little longer over the years, by the way.
It has indeed. About 10 minutes or so will get you in and out. Yeah.
That's right. Well, you can find Chuck and I over at the Technorama podcast. Go search for Technorama podcast on Google or any of your pod catching clients, and you should find us.
All right. Sounds good. So it's time to hit the theme, boys.
Hit it.
My hand. Ow. Oh, well, if you like the show, please don't hurt yourself, but tell a friend about it and subscribe so you never miss an episode. We'd love to hear from you. Follow us on Twitter at The Topic Is Trek. Visit our Facebook page or visit thetopicistrek.com. Until next time, on behalf of Chuck, Craig, and myself, I'm Clinton, thanking you for listening. And as we always say here on The Topic Is Trek,
don't put on the red shirt.
Perfect.
And watch out for the red matter.
Olson had the charges.
Who's up for fried targ?